I'm going to go ahead and read the thing. The setting is one of crushing poverty, a uniquely British slum made up of factory workers, rag pickers, street sweepers, sex workers, and criminals ranging from burglary gangs to murderers. In Victorian London, the honest folks living there were mostly Irish, having no other prospects for employment or housing. The streets were narrow, rat-nest alleyways. Open sewers bled their sour odors into the streets. With no regulations or building codes, the inhabitants were stuffed into collapsing wooden structures piled on top of each other, their foundations decaying and their walls rotting and covered in filth. There was no system of sanitation. The Monument to Industry was the local brewery, with its back to the St. Giles slum, its chimney towers belching over the alleyways. The smell of the fermenting materials of the brewings of beer and the occasional groan from the storage vats inside its storeroom were common sounds and scents of the neighborhood. They brewed porter here, a very dark and well-hopped beer that was developed in London and at one point was the most popular beer. They brewed a lot of it. On October 17th, 1814, disaster struck. At the end of it, 8 people had died, and many rickety slum buildings had been destroyed. On this episode of Relative Disasters, the London Beer Flood of 1814. Welcome to Relative Disasters, the show where I age some research in fine oaken casks, then carefully pour that out into a podcast that I send out to my sister and anyone else who feels like listening. My much cooler big sister and I manage our existential dread by talking with each other about terrible and interesting historical events, their contexts, implications, and any related sidebars that tend to be distracting. My name is Greg, my sister's name is Ella, and Ella, it's another man-made flood episode. This one was suggested to us shortly after we did our Boston Molasses Flood episode, and there are some interesting parallels. Our sources for this episode include Beer, The Story of the Pint by Martin Cornell, published in 2003. Mr. Cornell also wrote a very illuminating article on his Zethophile blog in 2010, as well as contemporary articles from the Morning Gazette, Morning Chronicle, and Kentish Gazette from October 19th, 20th, and 25th of 1814, respectively. So, let's talk about beer. Porter is a uniquely British beer invention, probably developed around 1721 in London. Back in the day, porter was a strong beer at about 6.6 alcohol by volume, over a percentage and a half more than modern malt liquor, and we know this because the hydrometer was developed in the 1770s specifically to measure the original gravity of porter. Porter was a big deal, y'all. For most of the 1700s, it was thought that the proper way to make porter was to mature it in very large vats, from anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half. Since the cost of storing beer for that length of time was expensive, around 1800 many brewers began to blend their porters. They'd age a vat or two for an 18-month period, and then mix that with fresh porter at a rate of about one part aged to two parts new, and be able to rack it into casks for consumption right away. One of the pioneers of this method was the Horseshoe Brewery, named for its Horseshoe Tavern, itself named for the design of its dining room. The Horseshoe had been established in 1623, and when the brewery was established, it bought into the porter craze in the mid-1700s. By 1787, it was one of the largest porter brewers in London, making over 40,000 barrels a year. In 1792, it was sold to a John Stevenson the Younger, son of John Stevenson the Elder. He died in 1794 after losing his balance and falling into a vat where he drowned. The workers who tried to rescue him saw his familiar straw hat floating on the surface and recovered his body, but he had already drowned. The brewery was bought by a partnership and run until 1809 when it was sold to Henry Muse. The brewery was renamed Muse Brewery, and it would keep that name until the 1960s. Sir Henry Muse, 1st Baronet, was an interesting fellow. He was the son of a brewer and grew up learning the business from his father. In 1795, the elder Muse had a small claim to fame in London by building the largest vat in the world, holding 20,000 barrels. Henry and his father had a falling out in 1809, and in a true "you don't understand me" / "well then I'm going to build an even better brewery" move, Henry purchased the Horseshoe Brewery and renamed it. By the time of the events of 1814, Muse Brewery was one of the 6 largest producers of porter in London, making over 100,000 barrels a year. The brewery sat at the junction of Tottenham Court Road and Oxford Street, both very nice places nowadays, but back then, it was a rookery. A rookery is a term that's fallen out of use, but it is an interesting term for what we would call a slum today. Not up-to-code buildings crammed together, people living in the most abject poverty, no access to sanitation. The word slum actually comes from East End slang for a room. Since London's East End fell into the conditions described due to intense overcrowding due to rapid industrialization, the word slum became a term for street of poor people. And the term rookery, used most to describe the area of the Muse Brewery, came about as a description due to how rooks, the birds, not the chess pieces, tend to nest in large colonies of a bunch of nests smashed together on the in the treetops. They are noisy and covered in poop, so when people were crammed into similar conditions, the name stuck. The St. Giles Rookery was maybe the worst one in London. About 30,000 people lived in just under 8 acres north of the St. Giles Church. Fun mini sidebar, that church has been there since Saxon times. And as you can tell from basic math, those people had nowhere to live. The majority were Irish migrants, shoved aside and made to take on the worst jobs or turn to crime to survive. One resident described it in the following way, quote, "We live in muck and filth. We have no toilets, no dustbins, no drains, no water supplies, and no sewers," end quote. Mortality was high, especially when typhoid, cholera, or tuberculosis decided to sweep through, wiping out thousands of people at a go. The people not living in the same conditions tend to view it as a, quote, "Irish problem and lower class issue," end quote. Home gin stills were common, as was survival sex work and all manner of criminal acts. The police did not venture into the rookery, even in force. One of the few times they did was actually to give the author Charles Dickens a tour. He was escorted by 6 members of Scotland Yard and a full squad of policemen. Dickens wrote about rookeries from this experience in Oliver Twist and Sketches by Boz. Now, behind the Muse Brewery was New Street, a cul-de-sac inside the St. Giles Rookery. The Muse storehouse, where its vats of aging porter were being stored for later blending, had its back wall up against New Street. And these vats were big. Muse's dad might have made the biggest one, but the one in question at the Muse Brewery storehouse was huge. 22 feet tall, 6.7 meters, holding about 3,500 barrels when full. That's almost 128,000 imperial gallons of beer. The vat was bound with huge iron bands about a foot apart, each band weighing about 700 pounds or 320 kilograms. Around 4:30 in the afternoon, one of those iron bands fell off. George Crick, the storehouse manager, wasn't too alarmed. The bands fell off 2 or 3 times a year. He made a note to get somebody to come in and fix it, and to let management know. Now, the vat was filled almost to the brim at its full capacity of 128,000 gallons. About an hour later, a wrenching, roaring sound shattered through the building. Crick ran to see what had happened, and what he found was that the vat had burst. The wall behind the vat, the 25-foot-high, 60-foot-long, 22-inch-thick wall, was destroyed, and part of the roof had been pulled down with it. The force of the released beer had broken open another vat and several hogsheads of porter in the storehouse, sending another 50,000 gallons out into the flood. The workers were struggling through waist-high porter trying to rescue their colleagues as almost 600 tons of beer in a wave that reached 15 feet in height roared out onto New Street and the surroundings. It smashed through the rickety buildings, sweeping people up and out. A 4-year-old girl was having tea with her mother when the flood hit, sweeping both of them out of the house through a window, killing her on impact and badly injuring her mother. Another child in the house barely escaped drowning as the beer receded. A 14-year-old girl who was washing pots at an outdoor water pump was caught under the falling rubble as the back of her building collapsed. She was dug out 3 hours later, and they found her dead but still standing. The worst deaths were the people in one of the New Street cellars. They were holding a wake for a 2-year-old boy who had died the day before. When the flood came, it crushed or drowned 5 of the mourning family and friends, including the boy's mother, 3 women, and a 3-year-old boy. The only surviving eyewitness account comes from a very unlikely source. An American man, traveling through London, recounted his experience to the New York City Knickerbocker magazine. Quote, "All at once, I found myself borne onward with great velocity by a torrent which burst upon me so suddenly as to almost deprive me of breath. A roar as of falling buildings at a distance and suffocating fumes were in my ears and nostrils. I was rescued with great difficulty by the people who immediately collected around me, and from whom I learned the nature of the disaster which had befallen me. An immense vat belonging to a brew house and containing 4,000 or 5,000 barrels of strong beer had suddenly burst and swept everything before it. Whole dwellings were literally riddled by the flood. Numbers were killed, and from among the crowds which filled the narrow passageways in every direction came the groans of sufferers." End quote. Rescuers arrived quickly to help, digging and trying to find survivors, including at least one small child injured but alive, rescued from the waves. I want to directly quote Martin Cornell, himself quoting the Morning Post. Quote, "The Morning Post, which said the scene behind the brewery resembled the aftermath of an earthquake, commended the several gentlemen drawn to the spot who were anxious to prevent any noise from among the crowd, that the persons who were employed in clearing away the rubbish might direct their ears to the ground in order to discover whether any of the victims were calling for assistance. It added that the caution and humanity with which the laborers proceeded in their distressing task deserves warm approbation, commenting that to those that even approached the scene of ruin, the fumes of the beer were very offensive and overpowering." End quote. It was tragic. But since it didn't happen to anyone they cared about, some of the newspapers, and of course some people in the years following, used it to perpetuate cultural and class-based disregard. We're going to put some of those to rest. Thing number one, people ran out to drink the beer. There are a lot of people who share funny stories about people going out and drinking this, and no, nobody did this. First of all, this wasn't really a situation where you could drink it. Much like the molasses flood, this beer was full of rocks, wood, pieces of the walls it had knocked down, and other assorted debris. This wasn't like somebody backing up a free beer truck. This was a tsunami that happened to be made of beer. People were crushed in the crowds of people getting free beer. No, again, nobody was drinking this. More people died from drinking the free beer than from the flood. Again, no. Not only are there no reports of this borderline sociopathic reporting, the only deaths were the people killed in the flood. Now, one particularly gross contemporary newspaper, the Bury and Norfolk Post, had made its bones in attacking Irish migrants whenever it could, in which they were certainly not unique, and so they may be the source for many of these kinds of stories. 9 days after the flood, they wrote an article saying, quote, When the beer began to flow, the neighborhood, consisting of the lower classes of the Irish, were busily employed in putting in their claim to a share, and every vessel from kettle to cask were put into requisition, and many of them were seen enjoying themselves at the expense of the proprietors. End quote. As Cornell points out, none of the other London papers report anything like this. It really seems like the Post just wanted to take a tragedy and inject a little extra cruelty for fun. So an inquiry was held, and it was determined that the 8 deaths and numerous injuries were caused by accident and misfortune, and that no one was directly to blame. With some help from the Crown, the brewery was able to rebuild and continued to do quite well for itself. The St. Giles Rookery continued to be a den of misery for the next 100 years or so. Fun fact, due to the outbreaks of disease, their graveyard ran out of room and people had to be buried elsewhere. But in 1900, it was folded into the greater borough of Holborn, and in 1965, folded into the borough of Camden. Its streets have long since lost their rookery traits and are now some very nice places to visit. I mean, I assume so. It's not like they could possibly be worse. The Muse Brewery closed its doors for good in 1921. It was demolished in 1922, and the Dominion Theater was built on its former site, with the building finished in 1929. The Muse name was briefly revived in the 1970s as a brand, but today, no trace of the brewer or brewery remains. Even porter isn't super popular anymore. And that's it. That's the story of the 1814 London Beer Flood. Here at Relative Disasters, we make sure to fact-check our work to bring you the most accurate disasters possible. If you'd like to know more about our sources, they are cited at the beginning of the episode. Sometimes we do make mistakes, of course, so if you have any thoughts you'd like to share or corrections we need to know, please write to us at relative.disasters@gmail.com. We cannot respond to emails, but we do read each one, we promise. Or if you'd like to shame us publicly, and we know you do, why not try our Instagram, at relative.disasters. A big thank you to our patrons who support us on Patreon. You guys are great and help us justify keeping this podcast ad-free. As always, we'd like to thank our major disasters, Katie and Georgia, for their support and their free tours of their Disasters Brewery. And this week's episode is brought to you by Sarah, famous for her iron-bound casks that are guaranteed to never bend or break, and by Beth, tried and convicted for her role in the lesser-known Milwaukee beer flood of 1702. Thank you all so much for joining us for this episode. I hope you've enjoyed the story, and I hope you'll join us again next week, where we'll be joined by a great guest. We're going to be staying in Britain to talk about a king so bad there have been no other kings with his name. On the next episode of Relative Disasters, we're going to talk about the reign and legacy of King John. Have a good week, and I'll see you then.